This morning we are continuing our time in the book of Psalms by studying Psalm 100. Please pray with me as we approach God's word this morning. Gracious God, give us humble, teachable, and obedient hearts that we may receive what you have revealed and do what you have commanded. Make us hunger for your word that it may nourish us in the ways of eternal life. Amen. A psalm for giving thanks. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him. Bless his name. For the Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. This is the word of the Lord. This week and last week, we've been having a new members class here at Fairview, and it's been really nice, and it's caused me to think about what we believe and how those beliefs flesh out in our practices. And making the curriculum was a little bit tricky for me because it requires boiling down these kind of dense and intricate theological questions into more simple and digestible answers. Last week we talked about Reformed theology and we got into the details of the 5 points and tulip and covenant theology, and it was a lot to take in, and I'm pretty sure that some of the eyes glazed over and they were not that interested in the details. On the other hand, we could boil it down to that simple essence of God is sovereign. Now, some of those are more manageable than others, and that's a lot of what we learn to do in seminary. We take an aspect of theology and we try to get it to a point where you can both delve deeply into it and produce a lot of pages and a lot of material talking about it, but you can also understand it well enough to explain it in a simple phrase or sentence. I remember when I was applying for this job, the PNC asked me for a statement of faith, and I think I told Jim, I said, I have a statement of faith that's one sentence long, one that's one page long, and one that's 47 pages long. Which one would you like? It reminds me of a man named Richard Feynman, who was a theoretical physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and taught at Caltech for any number of years, and he used to take great delight in not only teaching the really scientifically gifted, but he would teach basically intro to physics at the college because he wanted to be able to teach it to people who were art majors or history majors. And he believed that if you cannot explain something simply, then you don't really understand it. And that's some of what I want to do this week, continue with last week's focus on worship. After all, the Psalms are so much about worship, about the direction of worship and how we worship. Last week we talked about how worship requires joy and reverence and obedience. And this week the psalm continues to teach us about worship, but it takes both a wider view as well as boiling it down to that very essence, that core of what worship really is. Psalm 100 paints a picture that worship is so much more than praise, so much more than what happens here on Sunday morning. And it also shows that at its core, worship is simply a belief that the Lord is God and the Lord is good. That's what I want to talk about this morning, how worship extends beyond Sunday morning praise, how it includes thanksgiving for God's providence, and how it acknowledges his covenant faithfulness. First, worship extending beyond praise. It's starting to, election season is coming around, and I hear a lot of talk about polling, and I'm not going to get politically, but about polling is really interesting because there's a big gap in polls depending on the parameters of the poll. So that's why you see things that are completely off, whether you're polling registered voters or likely voters, whether you're looking at independents or people in swing states or certain districts or people of a certain socioeconomic class completely changes the numbers. If I polled the members at Fairview or even American Christians about what is the most well-known or most popular psalm, I think most of us would answer Psalm 23. That seems to be the one that's really stuck into our cultural lexicon, that we know when When trouble arises, we turn to Psalm 23. It's entered into the fabric of our spiritual lives, and we think about it often. But if we pulled the entirety of the Christian church, meaning the global church, and even if we were able to somehow pull the history of the church and all of the people for the centuries before us, the answer would be different. It would probably be this psalm, Psalm 100. See, it was used in worship so often that many scholars declare it to be the most well-known psalm of the Christian life, because churches would sing it every Sunday in the early church, and many Catholics or Anglicans prayed it every day. But what's so interesting about this is that right away, this psalm is about worship. It states that worship is about more than praise. It starts in the same place as last week with a joyful noise being made to God. But then the psalmist writes, "Serve the Lord with gladness." And then this phrase is parallel to "come into his presence with singing." The structure suggests that these two ideas, these two movements, these two actions are related. It's what we believe about our worship service. That's why we call it a service, and we believe that coming into his presence and serving him with gladness and praise are connected. Derek Kidner is an Old Testament scholar who wrote that worship is the first response we owe him, and not in either sense of the word, the last. It's the first response that we owe him. And this often escapes us. Too often we try to shrink worship down to our own understanding, to a manageable snack. Jenny said something to me last week after I preached on worship that the sermon seemed overly focused on the worship service. And that's what we picture when we think about worship, isn't it? We think about the hymns, we think about the praise songs, we think about 10:30 to 11:30 in this room. But worship is so much more than this. I was trying to come up with a Pennsylvania metaphor to explain this, where the hymns and the praise music were like townships, and the worship service was the school system or the county, and then our whole lives was the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but I started to confuse myself. But this is integral. It is of extreme importance that our understanding of worship be so much larger than the Sunday morning service, that it extends beyond this 1 hour of Sunday morning. Worship is a pivotal part of our spiritual lives. Paul said to the church in Rome, "To present yourselves as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." That worship is sacrifice. It is so much more than putting on our nice clothes and listening to a preacher for a little while, singing a few songs. It's full of service and sacrifice, and it applies not only on Sunday, but Monday through Saturday as well. What does this look like? What does worship look like on a Monday morning or a Friday night? Billy Graham famously said that the highest form of worship is the worship of unselfish Christian service. So it means that we are called to serve. Elsewhere in the Bible, we read that the purest form of worship is taking care of widows and orphans. But what else makes up worship? What else lives at the core of this idea? I believe it's this truth that the Lord is God and the Lord is good. That's what brings us to our second point this morning: thanksgiving for God's godliness. I've been staying up pretty late with Andrew. We have a baby that's about 3 weeks old. And so I've been staying up pretty late, and I try to take over the kind of late night so that Jenny can get some rest. And we kind of hang out and we watch TV while Jenny sleeps between feedings. Normally we try to watch the Cubs game, but if they're not on, we've been watching old episodes of Magnum P.I. Andrew's a big fan. For those of you who don't remember the show, the basic premise is that Tom Selleck is this Vietnam vet and private investigator in Hawaii who happens to live on the estate of this very wealthy and famous novelist. And so there's a lot of humor in this idea that Magnum has access to this amazing estate and beachfront, and he drives a Ferrari, and he has access to this club, even though as a private investigator, he never makes any money or has any money of his own. So obviously Magnum is very grateful for Robin Master's generosity, and it reminds me of when the psalm says that we enter his gates with thanksgiving. It's the same idea. When we enter this beautiful estate, this beautiful rest, this beautiful kingdom that we do not deserve to have access for, the only response is gratitude. In this way, Thanksgiving is a very natural response in our lives. Spurgeon said that as long as we are receivers of mercy, we must be givers of thanks. So if worship is a practice in the presence of God, like the psalm says, and we have not earned this presence, then we are always receivers of God's mercy. So we should always be thankful. I found a quote from a man named A.J. Gossip this week, who was a Scottish pastor and professor, who said that Thanksgiving is the language of heaven, and we had better learn it if we are not to be mere dumb aliens when we get there. His point is that Thanksgiving is natural and intrinsic into how we relate to God. Now, I'm not very good at this thankfulness. I think it's something that a lot of us in the church, especially Western Christians, struggle with. I used to have to write it out to remember to actually be thankful when I would pray. But it should flow very naturally. In Hebrews, we read, "Let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship." It's very clear we should be thankful because we have received so much. We should be thankful for God's holiness, for God's very identity. That means he is sovereign, he is in control, and he has power. And that thanksgiving, that gratitude for God's godliness can actually change our priorities. When we are thankful, we become more content, more satisfied, more in step with God. I was reading this week, there are actually scientific studies that prove this, that show people who express gratitude regularly have better mental and physical health, deal with less stress, and it has a positive, lasting impact on the brain, and it leads to more emotionally healthy lives. Thankfulness is important. Thankfulness is transformative. It's why Henry Nouwen wrote that perhaps nothing helps us make the movement from our little selves to a larger world than remembering God in gratitude. Such a perspective puts God in view in all of life, not just in the moments we set aside for worship or spiritual disciplines, not just in the moments when life seems easy. When we are grateful, when we give thanks for God's holiness and grants us access to God's perspective, God's vantage point. And this is not always easy to be thankful. It's a lot harder to give thanks when life doesn't seem easy, when loved ones are sick or when your family is struggling, but we are called to practice thanksgiving at all times. Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians, "Give thanks in all circumstances." And throughout the Bible, we see the people of God that despite their circumstances, because even on your worst day, the giving thanks despite their circumstances, because even on your worst day, the people of God, we have been given this amazing gift of God's mercy. We need this perspective in our lives on a daily basis. We need to not think of what we don't have, what we would like to have, what we might have one day in the future, but what God has given us and what we already have. We should be thankful for his mercy, for his holiness, and his faithfulness. That brings us to our third point that's tied up with this, acknowledgement that God is both good and faithful. See, the psalm gives us the ultimate reason why we should have this gratitude, why we should approach God with thanksgiving and enter his gates. As for the Lord is good, his steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. This is it. This is the reason for worship and for gratitude. The Lord is good. His love endures forever, and he has been faithful to all generations. Sinclair Ferguson is a Scottish theologian who actually pastors a church in South Carolina. And he said, "God's love is the most awesome thing about him. It is not his justice, nor his majesty, nor even his blazing holiness, but the fact that he has made and keeps a covenant of personal commitment and love to his people." And that's what this verse is getting at, God's covenant faithfulness that he has demonstrated to all generations and that endures forever. So I want to dig a little bit deeper into this idea of covenant. Richard Bauckham is a scholar who gave a basic definition of covenant. He said, "Covenants are the acts of God and the character description of God combining to indicate a consistent identity as the one who acts graciously towards his people and can be expected to do so." That Covenant means that God is gracious and that you can count on him to be gracious to you. That's what the psalm is getting at. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. The Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. God created us and has been dependable in his faithfulness and love ever since. In the Old Testament, God promised to multiply his people, to provide for his people, to be present with them as a part of this covenantal promise. The common refrain when God talked about the covenant in the Old Testament was, I will be your God, and you will be my people. Not only did God promise to be faithful, he put himself on the line. I just love this example that when people made covenant promises in the Old Testament. So when you wanted to sign a contract to buy a house or to sell your land, you would tear apart animals, and then the two of you would walk in between the animals. Because what you're saying is, if I should go back on my end of this agreement, may I be torn apart like these animals. You're literally putting your well-being on the line. That's how you would sign. That's how you put your word into an agreement in those days. But in Genesis, God caused Abraham to fall asleep, and then he passed through the animals himself, meaning that he was the only one with skin in the game in that covenant. But the people of Israel, just like you and me, were not chosen to be God's people because we are good or we are moral or because we follow directions well. When God tells us in Exodus that we are to be a treasured possession and a priestly nation, this is not based of our qualifications. One of my favorite books in the Bible is the book of Judges. We talked about this a little bit last week in the new members class, where every couple of years, I have a few friends who want to do a Bible study together, and I always end up bringing up, we should do the book of Judges. And normally I get about 3 or 4 weeks in before my friends get really upset at me and decide that they don't want to study the book of Judges anymore because it's rather sad and depressing. It's not a very encouraging book. See, what happens again and again in this book is that God's people find themselves in trouble of their own making. But because God is ever faithful, he intervenes to save them. And then right afterwards, God's people forget what he has done. And this is the refrain, they do what is right in their own eyes. And this pattern repeats itself again and again. And if we're honest with ourselves, it repeats in our lives as well. It is so easy to forget what God has done for us in creating us and creating the world and giving us these minds to think and the gifts of this world, not to mention the promise that he has given us of everlasting life and fellowship with him. But we spend our time trying to make our lives better, trying to make decisions that bring us comfort, convenience, and temporary or fleeting happiness. How many of us have something in our mind, that one thing that if we could just stretch and reach a little further and gain something, that it would make all the difference to us? If we could just get a new car, a better job, a healthier body, a healthier marriage, it would make all the difference and we would have everything we need. See, we are just like the people in the Old Testament who forget what God has done and do whatever is right in our own eyes. This condition, this selfishness of God's people is why near the end of the Old Testament, God's prophets begin to speak of a new covenant. The prophet Jeremiah writes, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people." And this is what happens with Jesus, that God demonstrates his love and his goodness and his faithfulness again. Just like in Genesis, God puts himself on the line. Jesus pays this price so that God can take us, a forgetful and self-centered people, and fulfill this promise to be our God, for us to be his people. That's what we need to acknowledge in our worship, not just here on Sunday, but throughout the week. And it must be expressed with joy and thankfulness that God has always demonstrated his goodness, his love, and his faithfulness. So that's a bit of what the covenant is. But what does that mean for us? What does that look like in our lives? You know, this week we've been talking about some bigger concepts, some things that are, I think, are really important to our theology and how we understand our spiritual lives. But what does that look like day to day? So I want to briefly go through a couple of these phrases that I hope are comforting. I hope are things that we can remember that can guide our faith and our practice. And then I want to just talk a little bit what they look like on a more granular level. First, worship is more than praise. It's a big concept, but what it means is that we should apply our worship attitude, our mindset, and our perspective that we have in worship and in the sanctuary outside of Sunday morning. So often we act differently during this time than we act when we go back home, when we go to work, when we interact with people who frustrate us. I remember an interview with David Gergen, who worked, I think, with every president including from Nixon to Clinton. And they were interviewing him and asking him about the leadership styles of all these different presidents that he worked with. And one thing he said of Nixon and Clinton was that they had two sides to themselves, to their personality. I think he said they had their Saturday night version and their Sunday morning version, talking about the duality of interacting with them on a daily basis. And I think that we're all like that on some level. We're all, we put our best face forward and we try to concentrate on God for an hour every Sunday morning. But are we taking the same posture of praise and worship throughout the week? Are we focusing on worship when we are not inside the sanctuary, when we are facing frustration or people who annoy us or family members or difficult coworkers? Number two, we should be thankful in good times and in bad, because it's all too easy to let the worldly concerns frame our gratitude. Can we tap into this eternal perspective, this godly perspective, that we should always be thankful because we are always receiving God's mercy and grace? Third, the Lord is God and the Lord is good. If we know that God is good and that we can trust him, we can go to him when we are in need of saving, in need of healing, in need of his power, because he has that power. He is God above all creation. That means that there is no situation that you can find yourself in where you are too far removed from his power or from his ability or from his inclination to save you, to heal you. For his love endures forever and his faithfulness extends to all generations. What does that mean? We know that God can reach for us, can save us, can heal us, because God has demonstrated this again and again throughout human history. And he promises that this love will never end, that God's faithfulness and love has been proven in the past, which makes it trustworthy. It is promised in the future, and we can experience it right now in the present. Finally, because he is our God and we are his people, just like all of the wedding imagery in the New Testament or the sheep, the shepherd imagery here in the Psalms and throughout the Bible, we are connected to him. We are wedded to him. We belong to him, and he takes this responsibility for us. He cares for us. He provides for us. He leads us, and he saves us. We were all made for a purpose, and we all belong to God.